Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 69 featuring our good friend Jeff Muddle, who we did a podcast with about a year ago over at GTC. So I was with Jeff at GTC this year, which is the GPU Technology Conference, which is done by NVIDIA. And we decided, hey, it's been a year. Let's see what's happened since the last time we talked about stuff. So it was really kind of interesting. We didn't know what we would talk about. It turns out there was actually a lot that has happened in the last year. One thing we didn't touch on, which I think was interesting, was Project Sohn. We actually forgot to talk about it on a podcast. Lon is joining me for the intro. Tell me a little bit more about Project Sohn.
Yeah, so... there's a great little project. It's being sponsored by Jeff Seitz, CG Architect, and mm-hmm. NVIDIA, and the guys at Autodesk.
Yep.
There's a couple of there's architects worldwide that are involved in this, including Ramza, Robert A.M. Stern's office. Mm-hmm. And essentially, there was this beautiful project by Sir John Sohn, mm-hmm. the Bank of... I forget if it's the Bank of London or the Bank of England, but okay. Anyway, it was sort of treasured... part of history, and it got destroyed.
Right.
And so now they're taking this opportunity to rebuild it virtually to incredible amounts of detail using Revit. So they're building this really beautiful Revit model. In fact, I believe the Revit model is done and ready.
Yes.
And we're sort of getting on board a little bit late in the game, but it's because we needed to get V-Ray for Revit up to a place where we could actually get it out there in front of people to let them... render it. So now the rendering competition is going on.
Yep.
And I think the grand prize is total something like $30,000 worth of great stuff. So
wow. Okay.
So it's pretty cool.
So we'll put some links up on that project and get more information. It sounds like a really interesting project. A lot of great sponsors on that and a lot of great designers involved in it, right?
Yeah. And in some ways, I kind of hope it becomes a trend because
yeah.
there's so many other projects that I could think of.
But it seems almost like open source design, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah. I really love that. That's really cool. Anyway, like I said, we didn't get a chance to talk about it on the podcast, but I figured we would mention it here and give you guys some links on it. A few things that we did talk about on the podcast, we talked about a lot about VR. Most of it is about VR because I think, you know, beginning of last year, we were saying maybe VR will catch on for architecture. And this year we're trying to say, actually, this is what has happened. We are really going to see this next year will be the litmus test for VR. And that's something that we're really looking forward to. So Jeff and I are already planning for GTC next year to see what's happened.
Well, let's embarrass Jeff for a second because it's a little known fact that Jeff's very first event when he first started CG Architect
yes.
was Build Boston out in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, he has air miles and flies all around the place
sure.
you know, and stays at great hotels, but yep. I actually put them up on my couch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the back in the days of, you know, doing this guerrilla style, we'll say.
Yep.
Yeah. And Jeff is the one human being I have seen in more cities than any other person in my entire life.
I would say the same thing.
I think we're at 15 or 16 or something
just
like
random
that
places around the world.
Yep.
Yep. I've seen Jeff more like I've seen him in Cancun. I've seen him in Spain. I've seen him just everywhere. So absolutely correct. We talk a little bit also about real-time versus pre-rendered because that was an important part of things. There's actually a lot of real-time stuff being done now in architecture, and it doesn't necessarily mean that pre-render is going away or even rendering is going away. That's actually a really interesting discussion we have. We talk also about the architecture opportunities of VR. What does VR actually mean as an architectural opportunity? GPU rendering, obviously, we're at GTC. We talk about the P100 processor. I want to clarify a few things because when we did this podcast, it was literally the day of the keynote, and we had no information about what this new card is. This card will actually this processor will actually go into video cards at some point. It was not introduced as such at the keynote, but it will go into these new types of cards. Don't know when the GeForce ones would come out or the GTX ones will come out. Don't know when the Quadro ones will come out. My guess is sometime within a year, maybe less. There are also going to be some very interesting things. They will be substantially faster than new cards out there. Don't know much more beyond that. We do have some interesting ideas of what possibly NVLink can be. So all of that's really interesting. Also talked about cloud, deep learning for a long part. To be honest, I think that is one of the most important part of what's going to happen in the computer field today is going to be deep learning. Before we go on, a couple other things. Lon, help me out here. We did have an Ask Vlado this week. Tell me what the Ask Vlado was.
Yeah, so this this question is coming from at Snakebox Media.
Yeah.
And the question for Vlado is, when you do programming, do you do it in music or silence?
Yeah.
And Vlado's response to this one, which I think we know this from, from is Vlado wants silence.
Yes.
He says here that he hates not being able to hear what's going on around him, so he doesn't like wearing headphones when he's working. And then when he's listening to music, his mind tries to follow the music, which makes him think about something else and then irritates him. So he says, I do like listening to music, just not when I'm working.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. And remember, you guys can ask your own Ask Vlados. Just send us on Facebook or Twitter or whatever with the hashtag Ask Vlado, and we'll be sure and send those over to him, and he will respond back, and we will read those on the air for you. So hopefully you guys can continue to do that. I thought these are pretty fun. FMX is going to be happening very, very soon, in about a week, and I will be there myself. I will be at FMX. There's a whole program of stuff going on there. If you want to know more about what Chaos Group is doing at FMX, go to fmx2016.chaosgroup.com. Check out all the cool things. I will be speaking on a panel about virtual humans hosted by Mike Seymour. And I will also be talking in a room where about some of the lab stuff we're doing. And I will possibly be at the booth space and talking about lab stuff there as well. So I really hope to see you there. Don't be shy to send a shout out. Let us know that you'll be there and you want to talk to me about stuff. I'll be more than glad to talk to you about stuff. All right, guys, without further ado, sorry for the long intro. Hopefully you enjoy the great podcast with Jeff Muddle from CG Architect. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Okay, so Jeff, you and I were here exactly a year ago. Actually, a little more than a year ago, because just GGC is a lot later than the last one, right?
Is that right? Was it? I can't even remember what time of year it was last time.
Yeah, it was... It was a little bit, it was, I guess, March. GTC is traditionally in March.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I decided I was going to do a podcast with you, and it was one of the first ones I've done on the subject of ArcViz, or the state of architecture and where it's going. And we had a really good talk, and I decided to say, hey, we should do one this year again to see what's happened over the course of a year. And you and I were thinking, it's like, well, actually, not much has happened, right? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And we were wondering, like, what was the problem? Where's the innovation, or where's the drive to innovation? Which was actually a subject we talked about last year. But suddenly this year, when we started talking about it, it's like there's actually a lot of things that have happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the, you know, the mainstream, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but, you know, if you look at the mainstream, you know, tech press, the Engadgets, the Gizmodos of the world, I mean, they're all calling this the year of VR.
Right.
You know, this is the year when it's all going to happen. And, you know, I mean, I'm starting to see some movement for sure. There's interest in you know, in ArcViz and architecture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this year, though, is going to be the litmus test. You know, I think... If we don't see some serious projects being done and, you know, architectural firms and visualization companies actually doing some serious projects with VR, I don't know that it's going to have the legs that everybody's kind of talking about, at least not in the professional sector within our industry, maybe right. The consumer side. But, you know, I think this is the year. This is the year.
Well, so it's only been, here's the thing, right? We're doing the whole hype check about VR and where it's going, but it really has only been literally a couple of weeks since the Vive has come out, right?
Yeah.
And the Rift as well.
Yep.
So you can only buy these products now, and they require a huge amount of hardware to make them viable.
Yes. Yep.
Both of those products have done very little effort in terms of the design market.
Yeah, it's funny. I just posted on my personal Facebook. I think you responded to a couple of those comments stuff, but I just posted on my personal Facebook the other day that, you know, over the last 20 years, I've seen so many products that, you know, come from another industry or a vendor manufacturer decides like, hey, I'm going to target ArcViz. And within 6 months to a year, they either decide like it's not worth the effort or they just disappear altogether.
Right.
And I think VR is kind of one of those things. I mean, I've seen it with Unreal and I've seen it with Unity. Certainly, you know, those are being used in the space, but as companies, they've evaluated the viability. You know, they've obviously come from gaming, but they've evaluated the architecture space, and you know, both of them have seriously. They've done their due diligence, and they've just decided that it's not. You know, they'd rather just stick with the gaming side. They realize it's a market, but they're not really prepared to invest the marketing dollars or whatnot to do it themselves. Third parties are doing it now, but not they don't.
But this
do
is something that architecture has done. To be honest, and I know I'm sort of attacking that field, but I think this is something that architecture has done to itself. Because let's say I'm a guy and I'm going to invest in VR, and I know there's $1 billion in VR going out right now, and we can talk about that at some point. You go into architecture, and what's the first thing you see? The cheapest people in the world.
It's very true. It's
right? It's like, I'm not spending $5.
Yeah.
Maybe $3. It's like, you know, and most everyone else is like, here, take my money, right?
Yeah.
And so architecture is the cheapest field in the world. So if you're going to have innovation, like in VR, they're looking at architecture and going, well, these guys are cheap, so screw it. I'm going to a game company that's just not afraid to spend money, right?
Yeah. And we spoke about this a little bit last year when we did the podcast. And, you know, for sure, architecture is probably the most risk-averse technology-wise industry I've ever seen. But it was interesting because I mentioned last year, like kind of anecdotally, 50% of people had purchased DK1s at the time, which is like, you know, why on earth? Like, the most risk-averse industry buying DK1s.
But they were not that expensive. You're basically asking for $300 at the time.
Right. But it wasn't so much the you know, the money for the device or the headset, but you know, the time it's going to take to actually try to figure out how
we use it. Oh, but they had no idea.
Yeah.
They assumed they could just put it on and it'll work.
Yeah.
They had no idea. And that's the thing, is I guess $300 was a very low in price of investment for a firm, right?
But I think the point being is like the fact that architecture, who traditionally just doesn't adopt new tech, like bleeding edge tech like that, the fact that they did it, I think speaks volumes to, in theory, the potential of what this has in our industry. And I think it does. I think it really does. But I think, you know, all the conversations I've had are, you know, if this tool only is a tool for walking around a space, it's probably going to have a limited lifespan. I think there needs to be another layer of complexity and value to how that's implemented.
But the difference between walking around a rendered space or seeing a rendering on a sheet of paper is massive. I mean,
and this is the thing. So, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, whether it's this internal stakeholder, the owners, an architectural firm, probably not so much Viz firms, or even a client, you know, of these Viz firms. Initially, their reaction is like, I'm not really interested in this VR thing. But as soon as you put it on them and they actually get that first time, they actually get that sense of scale.
Yep.
And until you've actually tried it, and I think even to this point, there are probably a vast number of people in our industry who have not tried this stuff.
Yes, indeed.
You have to do it. Either you can read reviews, you can, you know, imagine it. Until you put that on your head, you really cannot imagine.
You don't understand the value of it.
Exactly. And this is the thing. So these clients or internal stakeholders, or company architectural firm owners are kind of poo-pooing the idea like, I'm not really interested in this. And then they put it on and they're like, oh my God.
Now,
like,
I get it.
Order 20 of these.
Yeah. And that's exactly the same thing. I think Scott DeWitty, who we did a podcast with over at Gensler, he was telling me the same thing. I was like, no. Just put it on. And then I don't have to tell you anything more. I don't have to sell you anything else. You just have to see it.
Yep.
And it does. You're right. It does work. And that's effective. The problem is, like you said, I don't think enough people have actually put it on. I don't think enough people have actually seen it. And I don't think enough people know how to make content for it.
Yeah. And well, I think there's, you know, that initial wow factor is the novelty factor. So, mm-hmm. you know, that will last a certain amount of time for a certain number of people. But after the novelty wears off, okay, how do we make this a serious product?
So this brings up a point. Do you think that companies out there that that do that every day, let's say you go to, you know, architecture firm XYZ and you're like, you see a VR experience and then you're going to build another building and you bid a bunch of architecture firms and you go to a place and they don't have a VR experience. It's like, oh, well, they don't even have VR. So why the hell would I go to those guys? Do you think it's actually a competitive advantage to use VR?
I don't think we're there yet.
I think we're there yet. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe there's a potential to be there. I mean, again, this is a tool in a very, very large toolkit of architecture, right?
I think it certainly, and we've discussed it before, it enables the decision making to be a lot faster.
So last year I worked with Unity to create a kind of a state of the union of kind of where, you know, VR real time was in architecture. And, you know, I spoke to Scott DeWoody and a number of others about kind of how they were using the technology. And it was really not so much yet in the marketing imagery, but interestingly enough, in the design phase. And that's where they're seeing the most value, at least within an architectural firm, is, you know, just get a headset on these guys and they can actually experience what they're designing, you know,
right,
as they're going. I mean, it's rather than just getting a SketchUp model and chucking it up on a board on the wall, you know, now they're able to actually kind of get that sense of scale. And that's the most important thing, I think. So far, you know, the interaction or the, you know, the other things that could be added to a VR experience, it's been the scale so far that has been the biggest driver of all this.
So you feel that based on your conversations, that the greatest value that people have had with VR in architecture is it accelerates the decision making.
Yeah, I mean,
because they can see something that they've never seen before or been able to visualize as at perceived scale, like real scale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny, you know, until you actually put one of these on, it's really it's impossible to describe. I mean, it literally is like being there. And it's interesting too, because Autodesk just came out in December at Autodesk University. They came out with their new Stingray engine, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a new product. They made an acquisition to get that, and you know, the visual fidelity compared to, you know, the Unreals and the Unity's world arguably is not on par. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting, you know, so I put on the HTC Vive, and if I had just seen screenshots of what was being done, I'd be like, well, it's not a Unity, so I could easily just walk away. But as soon as you put that headset on and you get the sense of scale for, you know, first and foremost, but also there was a layer of interactivity. So I could like turn walls transparent. I could teleport myself between mm-hmm. areas within the room. I could change finishes. I could open doors. You know, once I started to do that, it's interesting, even though the visual fidelity was, you know, arguably low, that was kind of like in the background. It wasn't even, you know, even the aliasing, I was starting to notice weird aliasing artifacts initially, but like all of that stuff just kind of
it doesn't matter, because really what you've gotten is the scale.
It is yeah. The scale and the
it's so weird. Like if we could sum up like the fact that the importance of VR is scale, and I think that's true.
Yeah.
For the architecture community, it's big, and it's the same thing for any product design as well. Like a lot of people are talking about VR for automotive, right?
Right.
If you go into a car, you look at it, it's like, oh, this is how big the car looks, and this is where the door handle is. Now, most cars are almost exactly the same height. The door handles are almost always the same thing.
Right.
But if you actually sit in the thing and he's like, oh, this back is really spacious, mm-hmm. that has a value.
Yeah.
Right? You can't do a 360 video on your web browser and show you how spacious the backseat really is until you put that headset on.
Even though you look at the stuff that's the Gear VR, where you're you know essentially just rendering out a mm-hmm. you know spherical cube map.
Yeah.
Until recently, until the Vive came out, you know, higher res, a little bit better tracking and whatnot. Those Gear VRs, I put that on. I mean, it's just a still image, but again, the scale, and you have the visual fidelity because you're just looking at a really high res image.
Sure. But I think that, you know, here, okay, let's talk about this specifically, because we've talked about the different levels of VR, and there's different, you know, let's call them levels of VR for now, which are important. A lot of people are like saying, you know, the lower levels are BS, and then you want to go to the full HTC Vive experience where you're walking around the space. And I agree that that's, of course, the end goal. But as you said, like, just being able to have a nodal experience, and what I mean by nodal experience is that you can strap something to your head or use a Google Cardboard and look around. That's like 90% of what you talked about, right?
Yeah.
You get the scale from that.
Yep, absolutely.
So, yeah. so this is something that I think architects today can do out of the box. They don't need a programmer. They don't need anything.
Yeah.
And they are not quite doing it yet. I've heard of a few people who are like, oh, and they finally figured out that all they have to do is just render a cube map.
Yeah, right.
And then they can do that. And like, oh, I get it. But the adoption rate is actually very slow.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, it comes down to you don't know what you don't know. Right.
So is it an education thing?
I think, you know, we were just talking about it a minute ago. I mean, the Vive just came out, the release of, right. You know, the final Oculus just came out. People just don't have, you know, even if they adopted the early DK1 versions, they just don't have the, you know, the anything implemented in a real way to actually experience it. And then I think to even at that, as an industry wide, too few people have even tried it, even anything, any version.
Right.
So until they try it, you just don't get it. There's no way to describe it.
There's otherwise. No way to describe it. And you're right. I mean, and the fact is there are experiences that you can get. Just to give you guys, okay, I'm just going to say this just to plug my own stuff. But if you guys happen to have a Google Cardboard, mm-hmm. And you guys go out there, you know, you got one from New York Times or whatever, or you can easily find someone who has one or whatever. They're easy to find. They cost $5 generally to get, but most of the time they're distributed freely to people. If you go to labs.chaosgroup.com and you look up some of the VR stuff we've done, it's actually been something that this great guy named Stanley Bruce has made a website that you can load on your phone, and we've got an example of this, and we've done some great ArcViz examples. You go there, you load it in your browser. There's no app to download on your phone, whatever. You load it in your browser and you turn your phone, you hit the Cardboard icon, you turn your phone landscape, slip it into Cardboard, and you look around. And that's literally all you have to do to just get a glimpse at the beginning of VR.
Right.
And it's going to be, trust me, enough to say, oh, it's only going to get better from here.
Yeah.
Then that's what you get. And the fact is, what I've just explained to you does not involve a huge infrastructure. What I've explained to you involves rendering with the tools you already know. Whether it's V-Ray or anything else, doesn't matter. It's supported natively in V-Ray, both from GPU or not. I should mention GPU because we're at GTC. But it's something you can do right now and start rendering and create content without actually having to develop much at all. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so you had just done an interview, you were saying, with the guys from Iris. So I had just had the opportunity here at GTC to try the guys from Iris. So the guys from Iris essentially allow you to take your Revit file or your SketchUp file, mm-hmm. you press export, and then you just use your HTC Vive or a Gear VR.
Not a Gear VR, an Oculus.
Yeah, well, they have a Gear VR version as well now, too.
They do?
Yep.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So, but you literally export it, so you've got the same visual fidelity as that you would have in your, you know, SketchUp or Revit browser. But again, yeah. We're talking about scale and whatnot. So I the example they showed me was
it's super simple quality.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same quality you see in the viewport of SketchUp, for example.
It's a video game, low video game quality, but like you said, you get the scale.
And the thing that I thought was cool too, I mean, just like SketchUp, you have the sunlight, so you can actually do shadow studies in real time. So I'm standing in this kind of open space, and there's some buildings around me, and I'm using one of the Vive hand controllers.
Yep.
And I hold it down, and the sun starts moving, and I see the shadows from this position I'm standing in this open yep. space, and then all of a sudden the stars show up, and they're rotating around me. It was kind of cool. It was really cool.
No, I think it's great, and I think...
And it's easy. It's like you literally press export, and you're ready to go. There's no preparation.
Yeah, there are people out there. It's not as much as the game industry. It's not as much as the hype that you're hearing out there, but there are people out there, including people at, you know, both at Iris VR, and there's Insight VR, and there's a bunch of other places, and even some of the stuff that Stanley Bruce is doing, that he's done stuff that just works directly in a browser for you. There are people out there that are making tools that are available to architects that minimizes that problem, which is what I want to talk about right now. The problem is the technology gap, right? It's the, you know, because that's something we talked about last year, where like back when I was in ArcViz, like you hired some nerd like me
right.
to make you to make your visualization yeah. because I figured out all the complicated crap that he had yeah. to deal with. Now it's like someone that uses SketchUp just wants to push a button and make a render. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you look at architecture in general and visualization. I mean, I think the 80-20 rule holds true, you know.
Tell me about the 80-20 rule.
You know, so I mean, this is, you know, I've never done a hard and fast study on it or anything, mm-hmm. but I mean, I would hazard a guess from my experience that, you know, 20% of the industry, you know, does the marketing imagery mm-hmm. and the other 80% is what you do, you know, your basic.
But rendering, but still
SketchUp,
rendering.
SketchUp render or a Revit render or whatever it is, you know, that's done during the design phase, or maybe you just don't need high fidelity renderings. And that's what you use for your, you know, your end phase for whatever.
So that means that you no longer want to, your rendering has to happen without you having to rely on expert visualization yeah. people.
I think the vast majority of visualization in architecture is done without a specialist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we've established that the vast majority of visualization is without an expert. We've also established that most of the VR experience has a greatest value in the non-marketing part,
in
the design phase.
Yeah.
So that means that VR has to exist without any experts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you
need. Which means the tools need to be developed with that in mind.
With that in mind.
Yeah. So okay. the Unreals, the Unities of the world, those guys, they came from the gaming world. They don't have a.
They're used to people workflow. Just. Yeah. They're just used to people who know how to yeah. program. They're way more technical.
Yeah. I mean, when you see the marketing, the 20% marketing imagery or the marketing VR,
yeah.
that's where that exists. That's never, at least everything I know. That will never exist, in
right.
my opinion. Will never exist. The Unities, the Unreals will never develop a tool that will be targeted towards, you know, put one click, there's my model, and it's
no,
super
but, okay,
photoreal.
No, okay, okay, but someone like Iris, someone like Shane is basically trying to create that, right?
Yeah, but again, they're not doing the visual fidelity. So that was interesting that I was talking to him today, and I said, you know, look, is it on your roadmap to ever have, like, super photoreal? And they said, well, you know, that would be nice, but, you know, that's not our immediate goal.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't think it needs to be.
Well, okay. All right. We're going to talk about the real-time thing in a second, because I want to transition to that. But I think VR is kind of an interesting idea right now. I know it's like, oh, Ty's talking about VR again. Yes, we are talking about VR again. And there's an important reason we're talking about VR, because right now, like you said, last year, it was only last year, we were like, maybe architecture should look at VR more.
Right.
And now a year later, it's like, okay, architecture is looking at VR. We've seen a few things happening, but we haven't necessarily seen the mass adoption yet. What do you envision a year from now? Again, because like we've seen a little bit of an uptick, right?
Yeah.
But what do you envision next year?
So we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and if you look at the... you know, the hype cycle that, mm-hmm. And why am I forgetting the name of the company that puts it out there? Gartner's.
Okay.
So, you know, they publish a hype cycle, which charts the progress of emerging technologies and where they are in kind of mainstream
and
adoption.
And there's a graph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just Google, hype cycle, Gartner's, GARTNERS. And if you look at the latest 2015 one, you know, there's, it's a big peak and then it drops into a trough. They call it the trough of disillusionment. This is kind of, you know, the highest peak is when you see all of the mainstream press just jumping over something like, you know, like desktop consumer 3D printing was a year or two ago. You know, and then it drops into this trough of disillusionment, they call it. And this is where, you know, they start to realize all the delusions of grandeur they had about where this technology could go. And then they're starting to think, okay, well, realistically, this is only going to be here. And then it starts to plateau a little bit. And then we start to get into, you know, second, third gen products and then, you know, actual mainstream adoption. And then, you know, that's kind of the history of the product. So the where they're plotting VR right now is kind of just exiting this trough of disillusionment. And I don't know, I kind of disagree.
I think we're still on the hype side. Yeah. I think we're on the high side.
I think we've definitely passed the peak for sure. But I think we're kind of either in the trough a little bit still or just entering that trough. Because, you know, I was here at GTC and I'm sitting in some sessions today and I just had this nagging feeling in the back of my head. Like, you know, these guys are drinking their own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
There's definitely potential for VR. Absolutely.
I've attended several, you know, VR conferences and I've been doing a bunch of that stuff. As some of the people know, like, you know, like, oh, well, Chaos Group isn't doing anything in VR. That's absolutely not true. We've actually invested a bunch of money into VR, including some major companies. And I've been following a lot of it. But there is what we're doing is we're not trying to, we're not trying to necessarily sell you on something.
Right.
In a lot of ways, and you look at some of these the news is coming out that the emperor has no clothes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a lot of like, oh yeah, it's gonna be this, it's gonna be that.
Well,
it's like
you were telling me that something like last year there was 800 companies that were
Let's go through that real quick because so people understand this thing. There's so much money going into VR, it's out of control. So this is based on the numbers I've seen from a few places. But the numbers are rough, so you don't quote me specifically on them. But about 3 years ago till about September of last year, there's been 780 companies of some kind that have started up VR exclusive. This does not include companies that were companies and then made a VR branch, right? So like a lot of visual effects companies made a little VR branch that are investing in it. These are startup companies that are 100% focused on VR and augmented reality. And that's September, which is a ridiculous number, right? Since September till February, that number has now gone to 2,200 companies.
Yeah, but if there was ever a definition of bubble, that's it.
Then it's going to be a bubble. So there's a lot of people who are like, a lot of them, I know these guys, and they're all very smart, and they're like, I quit my job, and I'm going to go in here, and I'm going to get a bunch of money to start my VR company. Now, why are they doing that? Because there is a ton of money that's being invested in this. So much so that they
billions
and billions of dollars are being invested into this field, and that's an important part of it. Now, where does architecture fit in there? Architecture is not investing any money into this field because of the problem we already discussed,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But money is being distributed into this field. So there's a different role that architecture has. And we discussed this as well earlier, as you said. Architecture could actually, instead of actually trying to invest money into VR, architecture could be capitalizing from it. And the reason they could is one of the biggest problems in my mind about the VR experience is it is one of the ugliest design places in the world because it's being designed by people who are developers and they're very smart and they're developing great technology, but they have no idea of how to make beautiful spaces. And VR is about going to a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that VR, and this is something we've discussed at Chaos Group for a while, and Lon is actually one of the people who really sort of pushed me to think this way. VR is a new real estate space. So if you're an architecture firm out there and you're wondering whether you should adopt VR or not, you may actually need to think right now, instead of adopting VR, you should think about how you're actually making VR. So instead of companies going up to you saying, make my building and I want to see a VR version of that building, instead of saying that, you should go after the people, the actual startups, the people that are giving money to VR and says, I will design VR for you. I will design space for you. The architects should have a role in designing beautiful virtual reality. They have the education. They have the knowledge of what a space needs to look like. They know how to make beautiful proportions. Architecture should be controlling virtual reality as a space.
Yeah. Well, I just met with a company at GTC on the floor, and they're a service provider. They're out of China, and they've got an office in San Francisco. I can't remember the name off the top of my head now, but they're only like, I think you said 2 or 3 years old, and they came out of real estate, the Chinese real estate market, and the entire company is built around providing, as a service provider, providing VR services, but it's been the real estate market that's driving it. It's not been the Viz companies or anything. I mean, they were invested in and developed in all the owners of the company.
But are they still developing real physical spaces?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm saying that architects can go in there and design virtual spaces that never get built. Why not? Like, I'm just saying, you know, okay, this is when this is recorded, I don't know when it comes out, but like last week, Zaha Hadid passed away, right? Which is a really unbelievably sad thing. And I think, you know, she's a very controversial person, et cetera. But I think it's like, oh, it's too early. Like, if she had another 30 years in her, she could have dominated virtual reality. Yeah. A Zaha Hadid designed virtual reality experience where she didn't have to worry about gravity or fire ratings on doors or handicap railings. And I'm not saying that those are not valuable things in the physical world. They are, of course. You want safety, you want to be able to accessibility. Yeah. But someone in a wheelchair would love to travel through a space where they don't have to worry where the freaking ramp is, right? You know, they would love to be able to do that kind of stuff. And I think that the VR space is unbelievably freeing as an architectural experience. Yeah. And I think that someone like a Zaha Hadid or any architects out there, that is a new real estate for you. Yeah. That is a real estate with no boundaries.
Yeah.
And they should be designing that stuff. Because right now, if you go to VR, why is it ugly? Because the architects didn't design it. It's being designed by non-designers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you kind of touch back on, you know, the realms of Second Life. I mean, that was a 2D plane, but, you know, Second Life didn't take off. I was just sitting in a session just not too long before our podcast here, and, you know, they were talking about, you know, how they were heavily involved in Second Life and how, you know, it's like the VR is going to just revive that whole feel. I don't know. I don't buy it. I don't think that there's always a case for anything. I mean, there'll always be a subset of people who will do something, but I don't know. I don't buy that there'll be virtual worlds that people will hang out in at least in the foreseeable future.
I do.
Yeah?
I do. I think that once that headset becomes comfortable, which is not quite there yet, but I think Gen 2 will be more comfortable for sure. And I've heard of people that said that I've been on a Vive for 4 hours or whatever, but have you seen the video of Oculus Face? Have you seen that?
No.
It's like, because you have this headset on, you know, and it's like basically like you have a ski mask on and you have those marks on your face.
Right.
It's like you've got Oculus Face. It's like you leave the house and you've got this, like, you know, this sunken in face around your thing. But anyway, I have a feeling that people are going to go out there and they're going to create something interesting. And then once the interactivity becomes interesting, and Second Life is all about kinky interaction with strangers, right?
Yeah.
And trust me, that's fine. Like, you're going to look at someone and you're like, I'm going to check you out or whatever. Yeah. I think people are going to do that. I think avatars are going to be huge. They're going to be, to be honest, if I'm going to put my money in VR and say, okay, what are the three things that are important in VR? I'm going to say, it's actually not going to be quality.
Yeah.
It's going to be good design, good, interesting, compelling design to go to. It's going to be avatars, and it's going to be some kind of level of comfort where something has to be figured out in terms of VR where I'm not banging into furniture in my house.
Right.
I have to have some way to navigate. Those are the three things that I think. If someone figures out good avatar, someone figures out a good navigation system, and someone designs good space, then VR is done. Then I think that's what it has come
to. See, to me, I think there's probably going to be more adoption and more like virtual tourism.
Mm.
I think if I had
same thing, you and I could be meeting in VR right now on a beach in Cancun.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that could be where we meet. But that's like then a VR experience.
Yeah.
That has to be you and I be comfortable, or you know, take your goggles off and you're like, oh crap, in my shitty apartment somewhere.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think. I mean, I just to me, I you know, as I'm just thinking of myself, and I generally when I tend to like latch on to something new, I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking like, how is it that every time I think something's cool and I'm like interested in it, that seems to be the trend? Like I definitely, somebody's smarter than me thinking about what that new technology is. But you know, I think kind of like virtual tourism. And if I was there was just a demo today of both Mars and Everest.
Yeah.
That were VR experiences.
Oh yeah.
So I'm thinking like, you know, if I've never been to Cambodia or Vietnam or something like that, and I'm probably never, maybe I'll never get to go there, but I could throw on a, you know, a virtual reality headset and somebody even suggested today that maybe there'll be like drone rental services where you can like rent a drone and it'll fly through some place in real time that you want to go.
Right.
Right. Like crazy, right? But
no, but it's really, well, first of all, the guys, over at X-Res, Eric Hansen, those guys. They
just did Everest, did they not?
They did. I don't know if they did Everest itself. No, they did. I think they did base camp at Everest. I know that.
Because Eric was up there a couple years ago.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I was like, I will travel the world to bring the world to you, right? So that's what Eric will do in a lot of interesting ways. And I think they're right. I think virtual tourism is going to be big. Yeah. I want to be able to go.
Documentary style VR. I think that's, I think there's some.
Absolutely. And I think those are happy memories, you know? So that would be really cool. Anyway, so don't want to drag on too much about VR, but I think we've covered a lot of it. I think that there's a lot of interesting things that are happening in VR. To sum that up, I think that the architectural community needs to be more involved in it. It needs to show people what it actually potentially can do. It is really probably best used in the design process more than the actual rendering. The rendering part is great. I mean, of course, but that should be a byproduct.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the ArcVis part of it or the marketing part of it. But in terms of the design process, it's got its biggest value. But I also think that it's in terms of people designing virtual reality experiences that the architect has an opportunity to have a completely new real estate, a completely new client base in that area. I think that's something that would be big.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this time next year, hopefully we'll do another one of these podcasts. I think if we don't see, you know, some sort of significant projects or significant VR that kind of influences the direction of where the industry could go or should go.
Sure.
If we don't see that in the next year, I don't know. I'd argue that it isn't going to take off like everybody's saying it is, at least not in the professional architectural space, maybe in the consumer space. But, you know, if we don't see something significant in the next year, I don't know. I'm on the fence.
You're on the fence. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm curious. I mean, like, well, okay, let's put it back to what you were saying earlier. You're like basically saying that the hype curve is too compressed, right? Meaning that people are already seeing themselves as coming out of it and sort of VR is not going to be big again. But you think that like, no, we're still at the top of the hype. We haven't got to the path of disillusionment or whatever that's called.
I still think we got a few. I mean, even if you look at that Gartner's hype cycle, I mean, even though they're saying we're exiting the trough, you know, they're still saying it's 5 to 10 years before we have, you know, second and third gen consumer, you know, mainstream products.
Right.
So I don't know. I think we're for sure five to 10 years. I agree with that part.
Okay.
I don't agree where they say we are on the trough, at least not within our industry.
Right. Right, right, right. Okay. So, all right. So then it brings up another point that we want to talk about because there's a lot of things that we're doing. We're overseeing, obviously here at GTC, which is a lot. Even though VR has obviously pretty much VR has infiltrated pretty much every conference you've gone to.
Yeah. the last couple of years for sure.
That's all they're talking about, especially in our area. But what we're here mainly focusing on is obviously GPU rendering for what's going on. So what's your thoughts on GPU rendering at this point?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think. The very first exposure I had to GPU rendering was iRay, and it was here at GTC, and I want to say
it really? Was like, you didn't experience it in V-Ray back in 2008?
No, this was before RT. This is iRay not come out? I can't remember the timeline exactly, but I mean, the first time I was really like thinking like,
RT, you know, came out in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, probably about the same timeline.
GTC wasn't, the first one is in 2012.
Yeah. I mean, I remember SIGGRAPH when Vlado presented RT, but I don't think I really.
It's one of the first, it's probably one of the first implementations of a ray tracer on the GPU.
Yeah. I mean, it was even back then. I mean, if I remember correctly, I mean, when Vlado presented it, it wasn't presented as, you know, this is the next final frame render.
No,
is a preview tool.
This is exactly why it's called RT.
Yeah.
Right. And that's actually been, to be honest, it's been kind of a little bit of our curse because we've kept that mentality as far as our users are concerned, whereas like, oh, this is just a way to preview your stuff and not actually do final frame stuff.
Right? Well, even when iRay first came out, I mean, Michael Kaplan was the product manager for the tool. And, you know, that's how he was pitching it as well. iRay was a preview tool. It was not a final frame renderer. No. And over the last
few years, the hardware was not able to actually do final frame.
Exactly. Render. But over the last few years, you know, V-Ray RT, iRay, I mean, arguably, it could be a final frame render. If you throw enough hardware at it, it could be a final frame render, depending on what you want to do. But yeah, I mean, from an adoption standpoint, it still hasn't happened. I mean, when I first saw iRay, I mean, I saw the potential. I saw, you know, this could be literally, I'll still say that, you know, brute force rendering at some point, that will be the norm. I mean, I call it virtual photography. Rendering will not be a thing. We spoke about this last year. I still think that will happen. You know, I don't know what the timeline will be in it. And I think GPU or CPU will be the mechanism that happens. But yeah, as far as the GPU technology that we have now, it certainly didn't take off as fast as I thought they would. And even now, the adoption of those, I mean, certainly people are using V-Ray RT as a preview tool. There's a few people out there that are using it, even iRay for that matter, that are using it as a final frame render. But it's a pretty small percentage, like really small percentage of industry.
Do you think it's the same problem as the VR problem where they just haven't like picked it up lately?
I think it's a price point. I think it's a price problem.
Okay, what's the price problem?
I mean, so if you really want real time, I mean, if you really want that, you know, that dream of like you push a button and it's like the render's done, you got to throw, even now, you got to throw a lot of hardware at it.
Yeah, but what about the point that it just renders a whole lot faster than on a CPU?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Do people not care? If you had a choice between like an hour a frame and 5 minutes a frame?
Right.
Minutes a frame is not real time, but it's a whole lot faster than an hour a frame.
But that's the thing, right? So yes, I will agree. There are certain scenes that will render significantly faster on the GPU, absolutely.
Right.
But if you've got a really complex, diffusely lit interior scene that's like just, you know, through the windows from some direct light, that's not 5 minutes. That's still hours of rendering.
Is it? Why?
Oh yeah, and it's noisy. Even after.
That's if you do it 100% brute force. But if you have a light cache scenario.
Well, or if you use some of the denoising tools that are coming out there.
Sure.
And stuff,
okay. So actually, to be honest, like one of the big things, if you haven't tried it in a new V-Ray GPU, you can actually use light cache to do your secondary bounces, which actually clears up a majority of that, which is something that we offer. Once you get interiors, you're right. Interior renders, brute force, are tough, which is why a lot of those, let's quote unquote, unbiased renderers fail miserably at interiors because you need to be able to do biased lighting in those situations in order to get a clear render that happens faster. So therefore, you need to be able to do stuff. So the RT GPU actually supports that and you can do faster, and there's other solutions like denoising, etc. But I still am wondering, like, what is the dream? I guess that's the thing, right? The dream that you're basically talking about is real-time ray tracing.
Yeah. I mean, it should be virtual photography. I mean, I keep going back to this every time I talk about this.
It's so like, virtual photography.
It'll be, you know, you set up your scene, you spend whatever time you need to do to set up your scene, materials and modeling and all that. I mean, that's not going to change anytime soon, I don't think.
Right.
But that rendering part, you know, now we wait 20 minutes, hours, whatever it is, depending on how complex your scene is. I think at some point we're going to get, you know, where it's literally you push a button, you set the focus point, the exposure, and boom, 20 seconds, 10 seconds, 5 seconds is done.
Right.
But in order to do that now, and I think that's the thing, right? In order to, even if it's not instantaneous now, even if it's somewhat faster now, you got to spend a lot of money on hardware. I mean, you can't get more than currently. I think there's a few machines now though that are the high end ones that are, you can get some eight mm-hmm. GPUs into a machine now. But for the most part, most people's entry level machines, you can't get more than 4 cards into a machine.
Right.
And at that speed, and you know, in some, you know, affordable cards, some GTXs or something, it's still, you know, you're spending $3,000-$4,000 to put four GPUs in there.
So let's talk about real time then. Because I think this transitions really nicely. There's been a lot of hype about the fact that real time, and I don't want to call it hype because I think it's legitimate. There's been a lot of talk about how real time will eventually just replace offline rendering, which is, I agree with it.
Yeah.
Because who wants to wait for a render when you don't have to wait for a render? Now, does that actually mean that that rendering is going to be, what's going to become rendering? Because here's my point. I think that based on some conversations I've had with some of the guys at work, et cetera, that actually instead of people saying, oh, offline rendering, ray tracing is dead, it's going to be replaced by rasterized. There's no way that rasterized rendering is going to replace ray tracing.
Mm-hmm. No.
There's no way that rasterized rendering. So what's going to happen is, the real-time technology is going to go to ray tracing.
Yeah.
Eventually, that's the end goal. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Jensen today, right, at the keynote, he's like, what if you want real lighting? When he says real lighting, real stuff, like you have to make it look real, he's not talking about rasterizing. He's talking about ray tracing.
Yeah, brute force.
Yeah.
Full-on brute force. Yeah, I mean, I would say, again, going back to my 80-20, I bet 80% of the industry probably could care less if the lighting was like physically accurate.
Yeah, but no. Okay, I'm going to say yes and no, because to be honest, architecture has led the field of real lighting.
For sure. For sure.
And yeah, so I think architecture knows, has designed
that. But it's been the 20% of our industry that's led that.
Has it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, just looking at KS Group marketing. I mean, you look, you know, most of a good portion of your clients are architecture, but if you look at the marketing, a lot of it's VFX. Why? Because it's sexy. It's the same reason that, you know, the architecture industry has led lighting, you know, they're good at doing lighting and stuff, and then kind of VFX followed, but.
Yes. No,
yeah,
you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the VFX field was like stuck in the ambient occlusion world. Right. Like, architecture was doing real GI, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 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 Okay. So, what do you think needs to happen on the hardware rendering side of things for the adoption rate for the architecture field to go more towards that real time stuff?
I think we need to get to a point where, you know, you're purchasing one or two GPUs or your video card, whatever you want to call it.
And they're probably pretty cheap too.
Yeah. You know, when you're spending this is what I think. If you're going to spend sub $1,000 for one card and you can get, you know, maybe it's not absolute real time. I think that's still a ways away for this. Although they announced a card here at GTC this week that was like something like 20 times faster. Granted, it was for,
the Pascal card?
Yeah. I mean, that's a different
industry. I don't even know what that, okay, we're going to get to that later, but
But I mean, I think if you can get a card where, you know, you're exponentially increasing the speeds, you know, by just using GPU, and it's a single card and it's sub $1,000, I think that's where the point where it's like everybody's like on it.
Right. Right.
You know, But if you've got to buy four cars and you got to buy a monster workstation, I mean, people, it's probably cheaper and easier to just either rent a farm or build your own farm.
Perfect
CPU.
Perfect segue to cloud computing. So let's talk about cloud computing, because I think this is going to become an interesting part of the idea where, like, I don't want to invest in hardware. I just want to rent it on demand, right?
Yeah.
And there is a lot of computing power out there that's available to you where you don't actually have to purchase it, because computers are expensive.
Yeah.
And especially very high-end hardware is expensive, which basically sits on the shelf collecting dust.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
95% or more of the time.
Right, because most companies can't afford to be upgrading like every 6 months or right. every year, the whole farm.
So cloud computing has become a big thing, right? So now there's been some companies out there that have developed systems where you can have a full workstation desktop.
Through a browser.
Through a browser.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's beyond, I want a render farm. This is like, that's your work. Your work day happens inside of Chrome. It means basically you can open up a Chromebook and have a full on hardcore max Revit session going and design inside that. On your iPad or
so. So this is the funny thing. So I've been testing. You know, there's a number of companies. This is nothing new. Streamed applications. Yeah, yeah. Virtualizations.
Streamed applications.
It's not new.
Machine in a browser.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. What's new though is there's a number of companies coming out now that make having a streamed application, application to your browser really easy. You know, until now you needed some serious IT skill and a lot of money to implement, you know, a private cloud to do that.
Right.
Now it's like, you know, it's like getting a Dropbox. It's that simple. Some of these tools. What's interesting though is, you know, I've done some of these tests and all of these applications, I mean, all of these servers are remote, obviously, you know, the Amazons, the Microsoft, the Azures, they've got servers around the world. But what allows you to have a real-time experience is how close you are, in most cases, and how fast your internet connection is.
Your latency, yep.
Latency, yeah. How close you
latency
are.
Latency is going to be a word that's going to be used by your mom at some point.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm assuming they're going to... I don't think we're there yet. I mean, I think we're going to have to do a test. So, for example, I live in Canada, in Calgary, and I was testing on a server in San Jose. So, you know, probably a couple thousand miles away.
Yep.
But I was getting... I'm trying to think now. I think I was getting around 30 millisecond latency. Sounds like insignificant amounts of time. But when it actually comes... So I was working in 3ds Max in the browser and, you know, just orbiting things. It was pretty fast, but if I was actually doing production work, you would notice. Absolutely. I've heard
from people that like hard, especially like hardcore, super fast, I know, like Max or Maya users, they're like, it's like,
you gotta be like sub 15 second millisecond.
Way faster because like you're going to tear your hair out. It's like, oh
yeah.
Like you want to paint. And it's like, oh
yeah. So, and here's the other thing. So you think, okay, well, let's just say they speed it up or it's close enough. I was running it on my firewall and I wanted to see what the bandwidth I was pushing as I was testing it. So there's two ways you can have, because all they're doing is they're streaming H.264 to your browser.
You know,
it's just a film that they're streaming with a interaction layer over top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious to see what bandwidth. So they can either do... A constant bit rate or a variable bit rate, because it's an H.264, and so they cranked it up because I was noticing some weird artifacting, so they cranked it up to a constant bit rate, and you know a relatively high bit rate, and I wasn't noticing any artifacting when I was orbiting, because otherwise if you have a variable bit rate it's fast, but you get all sorts of weird like pixelation and stuff that's happening, and it's weird. So they cranked it up and I looked at the firewall to see, you know, what I was pushing, and I was just orbiting back and forth on a simple teapot just to see, you know, you're changing up the scene enough. It's enough. It was 40 megabit per second.
It's a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah. So and I asked the guys about it, the company that was doing this, and I said, like, you know, that's kind of what you see. And they're like, yeah. And I talked to some other people that were outside that had been testing this for other companies, for a number of years, you know, they know what they're doing, and they're all kind of 40 megabit per second. It's kind of like, if you want to do a constant bit rate, that's kind of what they're saying. So think about this. What is the average speed of a corporate internet connection.
Yeah, maybe 100 right? or a, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, right? So granted, maybe not everybody's like full on all the time, but what kind of scale can you do on a 100 megabit connection?
No, you're right. And so so that's going to be the thing is like that there's going to be a bandwidth and latency revolution in a lot of ways. And why do that? It's like, why not just buy your own computer? Because the fact is, eventually the cost of renting is going to be cheaper than owning.
Even now. So, I mean, you know, granted it's not absolutely real time. You will notice some lag in my experience. It's cheap. It's actually quite cheap.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I did, it was like, I can't remember the exact specs now. I'm probably going to quote this wrong, but I want to say it was like 20 core or something like that. You know,
it's a good workstation.
60 gigs of RAM or something. Yeah. It was a solid workstation. If I used it, I think I worked out the math. It was like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, 40 hours a week sort of thing for a month. It was like $500 or $600 a month.
Right.
Like dirt cheap. If I needed an extra workstation, why would I not do that? What's interesting,
that's though, if you use it all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Which if you don't use it, you're not. That's the thing, cloud computing, you pay for when you use and you don't pay for when you don't use.
Well, and this is the cool thing. So these new companies that are coming out now are allowing you to... so a lot of them are using existing cloud infrastructures, Amazon, Microsoft's, and so the Amazons, the Microsofts of the world price their computing power based on, you know, the size of the instance. So maybe it's a small instance, maybe it's a huge instance. But what's cool is you can actually, you know, within a few minutes, you know, decide, you know what, today I'm doing a bunch of emails. I don't need to pay for a 60 core, you know, 20 core or 64 gig machine to do emails.
Right.
So you can just downsize it, wait 5 minutes, and now you got a smaller machine.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if you had bought a physical workstation, you know, I think they've done the math on it and most people are not using their full kick-ass workstation, 100% utilization all the time.
Nope.
So there's some waste there. And this is where they think that there is some, you know, economies of scale is that, you know, they can up and down scale when you need it and for what you need to use it for.
Yeah.
But I think the missed opportunity though, at least right now, most of these companies are focusing on a workstation. You know, I will let you spin up a workstation or multiple
workstations. They're still thinking of it as a computer as a computer.
Yeah, yeah. But they don't let I could go in and I could spin up, you know, with different accounts, I could spin up 20 machines, but they're not set up in a way where I could actually let them talk to each other.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking if these guys actually kind of see the light, they could overnight basically put out of business most of the render farms out there who have built physical render farms on premise.
Right.
Versus, you know, cloud render farms that I can just spin up when I need them.
Right.
So I think if, you know, if they get to that point, I mean, I think most people won't need to use render farm services anymore. They could just spin up a cloud whenever they want. It'll take 20 minutes. Well, no, of course
it is. But that's the point. I mean, those render cloud services could be cloud-based or not.
For sure.
I just think like, and the thing is, it's always available, right? It's always going to be... it's always going to be there. It's always going to be available and it's always going to be upgradable, right? So you're going to pay the same price no matter what. And every time you use it, it'll be the latest shit. You don't need to worry about like, well, my computer's kind of slow. I need a new computer. Yeah. Like that conversation's going away.
Yeah. But going back to the GPU conversation in the cloud, almost at least from what I've seen so far, all of the big cloud providers, again, the Amazons and Microsofts, have GPU capabilities.
Of course.
But if you wanted to spin up 100 machines of GPUs, not going to happen.
No.
You would need to set up a specific contract for you that, yeah, I'm going to spin up 100 GPUs for a year and, you know, I'm going to pay you this much.
Yeah, no, GPU cloud is still very, very new. Small and very new. And they have to convince people that cloud computing definitely is happening. People use it every day. I use it. It's called Netflix.
right.
but in terms of like actual stuff that's happening on the processor in terms of choosing between CPU and GPU, I think that is going to be a slower adoption. They just have to prove that GPUs are going to be the future.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, from a business standpoint, why would any of these companies just go out and buy like, you know, 1,000 of the latest GPUs when there's not a market to use them?
Sure,
right?
Of course.
I mean, they're going to do it as the industry demands it.
Which we're kind of coming up on an hour, but I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. When you and I went to the keynote, obviously, today, which was Jensen's keynote. He's the CEO of NVIDIA, and he gave his big talk. And I'd say, 60% or more of his talk, maybe 75% of his talk, was about deep learning.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
If I was a venture capitalist right now, and I was going to invest in some Silicon Valley money right now,
be deep learning for sure.
You're right.
All day long.
Yeah. All day. Right.
Yeah.
Virtual reality is like Tinker Toys compared to deep learning.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, if I was going to invest big money in it would be definitely deep learning.
So
yeah.
Deep learning is insane and mind blowing and incredible. And that's the future in terms of a lot of this technology, including you want to know what's going to happen in VR? Don't worry. We'll make a deep learning computer to tell you what it's going to become. Yeah.
I mean, VR is like this like minuscule subset of like the world.
Right.
Whereas deep learning has the potential to like impact every single person on this planet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to change everything to the point where you don't actually have to. We can become very, very, very dumb because the computers will take care of us.
Yeah. Skynet, anybody?
Skynet, yeah. So deep learning is something obviously that's been very big, obviously. And NVIDIA, as they said, is all in, right?
Yeah.
So here's something that was interesting about the keynote. Last year, they announced all these cards. The year before that, they announced all these cards. Here's the next version of this cards. Here's the next generation. This year, they announced 0 GeForce cards.
Mm-hmm.
They announced 0 Quadro cards. They announced this new, I think it's called a
P100, I think.
P100?
Yeah.
Which is not even a card.
Yeah.
It's a processor.
Yeah. And it's like 25 times faster than previously.
It's out of control fast.
Yeah.
And it's not even geared towards graphics.
Yeah. It's like $125,000, if I remember the...
No.
That
okay.
was the so, other one? Was
no, that no, no. That's the box itself.
Right,
okay?
right. You're
so,
right. So
this processor is 100% geared towards deep learning. So that means NVIDIA is not even in the graphics game anymore.
Yeah.
They're
compute,
in the...
Compute.
They're in the compute artificial intelligence world. I don't know what that means to graphics because we're in the graphics world, obviously. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that means to graphics, but I know that obviously there's a huge impact on what's going to happen. And I know that the field of architecture design will, and I haven't figured it out yet because I'm digesting it from today, but the design world will be affected by deep learning in some fashion because that thing figures things out for you.
Yeah. I mean, in both, if you go to AU and even NVIDIA, I mean, they talk about generative design and stuff. And,
right.
And I think that power, that level of computing and that amount of power at your disposal, I mean, I can't help but think that in some way down the line is going to affect how we design and how we build things. I mean, those sorts of decisions rather than like, well, I think I'm going to design it this way. Does that work? Let's do the math. No, that doesn't work. Let's go back. You know, rather than like, you know what? These are my design parameters. Just throw it at the cloud. It's going to come up with like 8 million versions. And like, that's the perfect one. It just tells you what the perfect one is.
Yeah. Well, that was the example they used today, right? And just scale it to a different level. But they basically fed the computer, you know, thousands, 20,000, 30,000 impressionist paintings or something.
Right.
Kind of, right?
That was cool.
Right. You know? So they fed the computer literally just all these impressionist paintings that they came up with and had it learn. And by the way, I should note that they teach it only to learn from this. It learns on its own, and I'm not even kidding you, what a beach is, what a tree is, what this is, what that, because that it learns this on its own.
Yeah.
That's part of what happens in this process. And after a day of it learning this, whatever they did, they say, paint me a sunset beach scene in an impressionist style. And it made a pretty good freaking image.
Yeah. And then I think one of the other examples was like, you know, take this image and like don't have a night or don't have a beach or don't have this sort of sky.
Yeah, and no then, clouds.
Yeah.
I want less clouds and do it again. It's basically you're talking to the computer and you're asking it to do an impressionist painting for you and you're giving it exact like less clouds, this and that. And they made it. It like Okay, yeah. Was it the best? It was a Monet? No, because it's, you know, the problem with art direction, but...
yeah. But, I mean, I saw that, and I'm thinking, like, how is this going to impact the visualization industry?
How is it going to impact in design? It's like, You know, like, the ArcVis guy no longer... Like, what if rendering goes away? It's like, render me a building. Okay, I want the window there. No. Make me a bigger window.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Make me this. Okay. Yeah, all right. And then now it's not like... You're worrying about the scale or getting the Revit model or the normal.
I mean, an architect could be like, you know, like you say, to give it the design parameters and just say, you know, render it in impressionist style or render it in, like, you know, whatever style that you want, like photoreal or, you know, anything. And it just does it. Like,
it just does it.
Yeah. We're getting there. It's crazy.
I mean, almost it's like, you know, it was the thing about like, it was about direct control or learned control, or I forget the term they used. Yeah, but he basically, like, whether you tell it specifically what to do or whether it learns on its own how to do it, right? So what if ray tracing or any kind of computer, even I know they're actually doing some form of this for fluid dynamics, where they're like, you figure out how the fluid dynamic is going to be. So deep learning is actually happening in fluid dynamics. But what if ray tracing is like, give me an approximation of that space as far as deep learning, and it can do it instantly.
How could it not? I mean, the way light behaves is a known behavior.
Right. So learn how to draw it. Learn how to make it look photoreal. Yeah.
You know, like, I this is my building. I'd like to see it at 5 p.m. on a whatever.
Right.
And, you know, in this style. And you know, I want to see some people, and I want to see a car, and I want to see some lens flares, or I want to see some light streaks, or, you know, I want to see a big crowd. I want to see, like, you could just name your criteria, and it'll do it.
So let's go back to the example they used, because what they basically showed was... show me impressionist paintings, which is a painting and it's abstract. But you could say, learn from photoreal, you know, architecture, and now just make me a rendering that's photoreal architecture.
Yeah, I think everything I've seen suggests. I mean, it's crazy. It's Minority Report. It's Wag the Dog. It's like it's like every movie you've seen. Yes. It's like the holodeck. It's all there. It's coming.
Yeah,
I think. From what I've seen, at some point in the future, I don't even want to care to, you know, guess when that might be. But the technology and then the know-how and the thought process is there to, at some point, I think, where you just sort of decide what you want, and it just something, the computer does it for you.
Yep.
And it's done. I mean, you know, maybe it's 20, 50 years down the road, but probably a rendering specialist is gone.
I don't think it's that wrong. I believe in 5 years, it's going to be like, oh crap. This is going to happen.
Yeah.
And then 10 years from now, it's going to be like, how do we live with AI? How do we live with this? Right. Because
What did Jensen say during his keynote? He said that their internal rule is you're not allowed to have more than three miracles per project. And this new card had five miracles.
Right.
You know,
it's not a card. Yeah. This thing is like nothing NVIDIA has ever done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never seen anything like it. Yeah. I don't even know if we can, like, as I'm looking at it, I was like, can we use it for rendering?
Right.
I don't even know if we can use it for rendering.
Yeah, I don't either. I didn't quite get how it, if it's just another exponential leap in compute power. Oh,
yes.
Or is it like specialized in the way it does compute? I mean, my assumption is that it's just compute is compute. It doesn't matter what it is. You could potentially use it for graphics.
You could definitely. I think you can use it for anything, but I don't think it's. I don't know. It's a different. It's a.
Yeah.
I don't even know how much memory it has on it. I have no idea what it is.
I don't know.
It's not like, all right, so the next level of GPU is like this. Like, what the hell is this car? Yeah.
I mean, we, you know, for years, we, you know, it had been, and this is kind of why cloud came about, it because we hit Moore's law. You know, it stopped working. So people are like, okay, let's go to cloud because that's the only way to scale. It sounds like, maybe I'm wrong, but it sounds like we've kind of like, now we've passed it now. We figured out how to go one step before. Maybe it'll be some longer before we do the next leap, but
I don't know what this is.
The next leap, I think.
Right. You know? So, it's very, very interesting. It's just for people who are listening early and are wondering, well, how much does the thing cost? The only thing we really know about this thing is, like, it's not available in a card that I saw. They just talked about it as a chip.
Chip, yeah.
And it's a massive,
it's a big chip.
It's a big chip because it's huge. It's got 150 billion transistors or something ridiculous in it. But what it actually does is they've announced another appliance, kind of like the VCA, which holds eight of them, of these cards, and has a massive amount of throughput and all this crazy stuff on it, which is pretty much like as big as, according to them, the equivalent of 250 to 300 computers in a single computer in terms of actual floating point operations or what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, all the quotes were like from all the people from the supercomputer world is like, you know, this has revolutionized the industry.
Right, because basically one of these things could just like replace like a room of computers.
Yeah.
And it is $129,000 for one box, which is a bargain considering how much computer power it can replace.
Yeah, there wasn't he saying it was like probably like $3-5 million or something.
Yeah,
what it would
actually
cost.
It was like a couple million dollars just for the network to
the connectivity between all the machines.
Yeah, if you had to make a traditional CPU network of computers to make it, like it'd be almost $1 million of network just to make those computers talk to each other.
Right. Yeah.
So
exactly.
All right, we are wrapping up here because we got to get going and I got to get to eat. And I already just got a text from my friend, Stephen Parker, who's wants to get eating. Fantastic conversation. You and I were worried about like what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow we managed to fill over an hour. Imagine that.
Yeah, of good content, really good content. So, all right. Thanks a lot, Jeff. I hope you we can do this again next year. And I'm going to go ahead and let the last bucket drop. So, and we'll see you next year for another one of these. How's that sound?
Perfect. All right. See you next year.